I'd like to start a new series of teachings this morning, and as you know, once in a great while, I get excited about this. And how many of you have ever seen a cross? Okay, thank you. One person I have. How many of you have seen it on a piece of jewelry? Yeah, and how many of you have ever been in a particular circumstance and seen somebody wearing a piece of cross jewelry and said to yourself, I wonder if they know what it means? Yes, not excluding Madonna videos. And so there was this interesting moment when I wonder, how many of you ever thought, I wonder why they're wearing a cross? Yeah, which raises all sorts of questions. Do I know what it means? And are there other things that it means that I may have missed? And so I set out a while ago to begin exploring what else does it mean? Not like it doesn't mean what we think it means, what does the cross mean tomorrow when you go to school, when you go to work, when you drive in your car, when you deal with the people that you deal with? What does it mean tomorrow or later today when you meet up with somebody who you've had some rugged exchanges with and there's a little bit of weird blood between you? What does the cross mean for how we actually live tomorrow? Because for many people who would say, I believe in the cross, I assume the answer would be because Jesus died on the cross for my sins and someday I'm going to heaven, which we praise God for. My question would be, what does it mean tomorrow? And what does it mean 2 hours from now at lunch? And so over the next month or so, I'd like to explore what else is going on with the cross. And at a deeper level, what else or what is God saying to us through the cross? So let's start in the book of Matthew, chapter 21. Now, there are four accounts of Jesus' life, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they all move quite rapidly. They're all telling these stories of Jesus' life, and they move quite quickly until they get to the last hours of his life. So if you were to read them if it was like a movie, it would be a movie in which the scenes move really quickly from his birth through his life. But then when you get to the last hours of his life, they get really slow and they move and give you lots of detail. It's almost like the Gospels are introductions to the passages about his death. When it gets to Jesus' death, we get way more detail and we're told much in a much slower fashion about what's happening. Matthew 21, verse 23. Jesus entered the temple courts, and while he was teaching, the chief priests and the elders of the people came to him. By what authority are you doing these things? They asked. And who gave you this authority? These kinds of questions always put me in a good mood, don't they? You, when somebody questions your motives, or somebody asks, what right do you have to do this? Or essentially, in our language, it would be, who are you? But this always puts me in a wonderful mood. Now, turn ahead a couple chapters. Let's go to chapter 26. As we get down to these final scenes, one of the central things that keeps coming up is, who gave you this authority? Who are you? And who are you to do this? And how dare you say these things? They're going after his motivations. They're going after his credentials. They're going after what gives him the right to say and do this stuff. Notice 26, verse 14. Then one of the 12, these are his most intimate followers, his disciples, the one called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and asked, what are you willing to give me if I hand him over to you? So they counted out for him 30 silver coins. And from then on, Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. So one of his most intimate friends, one of his disciples who, along many timelines, has spent 3 years camping out with him, eating with him, traveling with him, learning from him, discussing with him. He's poured his life into Judas, and Judas is behind his back negotiating for how to sell out Jesus. And they agree upon 30 silver coins. So apparently the price that his friend has put on him is 30 silver coins. So I'm glad that nowadays nobody ever betrays a friend or anything, because Jesus' world was so different than ours. Turn ahead to the next section, verse 36. he predicts one of his disciples is going to deny him. Then verse 36, then Jesus, Matthew 26, went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to them, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." Going a little farther, he fell with his face to the ground and he prayed, "My Father, if it's possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will." Then he returned to his disciples and he found them, what's your text say? Sleeping, which is always a confidence booster. By the way, they just had a Passover meal, which involved 4 cups of wine. So it would be normal after the Passover meal that you'd go to sleep. "Could your men not keep watch with me for 1 hour? He asked Peter. "Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the body is weak." He went away a second time, verse 43. Then he came back and he found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. So his best friends aren't able to stay awake. They're not there for him in his time of need. So he left them, and when he went once more and prayed the third time, saying the same thing. Then he returned to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting?" So people are questioning his authority, and they're questioning his motives. One of his best friends is negotiating to sell him out behind his back. And then in his time of like greatest need, and he's like, my body is weak. His closest allies can't stay awake. Notice then he's turned over to the Sanhedrin, a religious group, and they ask him questions. Notice verse 67 of chapter 26. "He's worthy of death," they answered. Then, verse 67, they spit on his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, Christ, who hit you?" So he has his friends falling asleep on him. Other friends are betraying him behind his back. The religious establishment is questioning his motives and his authority. And then in verse 67, they spit in his face and they struck him with their fists and they slapped him and they said, "Prophesy to us, Christ, who hit you?" Then the next whole section, verse 69 to verse 75, is a friend of his named Peter. He's sitting in the courtyard and a young servant girl comes to him. "You also were with Jesus." Verse 70, but Peter denied it before them all. "I don't know what you are talking about," he said. Then he went out to the gateway where another girl saw him and said to the people there, "This fellow was with Jesus." And he denied it again with an oath. "I swear to you, I don't know the man." And after a little while, those standing there went up to Peter and said, "Surely you're one of them, for your accent gives you away." And then he began to call down curses on himself. And he swore to them, "I don't know the man." So one of your best friends denies that he even knows who you are. Now skip to the next chapter, chapter 27, verse 27. So he's questioned. He's betrayed behind his back. His friends keep falling asleep. They aren't there for him. And then one of his friends denies that he even knows him. Verse 27 of chapter 27. Then the governor's soldiers took Jesus into the praetorium and gathered the whole company of soldiers around him. They stripped him and put a scarlet robe on him. Then they twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand and knelt in front of him and mocked him. "Hail, King of the Jews," they said. They spit on him. Second time a reference to being spit on. They took the staff and struck him on the head again and again. So now he's beaten in the head with a club. After they had mocked him, they took off the robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him away to crucify him. They make him carry his cross for a little while. Then verse 41, in the same way the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders mocked him. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. He's the King of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we will believe in him. He trusts God. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. For he said, I'm the Son of God." In the same way, the robbers who were crucified with him also heaped insults on him. And then he ends up crying out to God, "Why have you forsaken me?" So this is the story we're given. every imaginable thing that could happen to somebody. Thank God the world's like that, not like that now, huh? Notice this, if we were just to make a list of all these things, he's questioned, he's betrayed, deserted, denied, spit on, struck in the face with fists, slapped, next, mocked, stripped naked, insulted, beaten, lied about, falsely accused, convicted, condemned, crucified, humiliated, scorned, pierced, bruised, rejected, hated, stared at, left naked in public to die, and killed. So this is the story of all of the things that happen to him. So what is his response to all of the things that happen to him? Next slide. Let's go to the book of, next slide, and then I'll tell you where we're going to go. Luke 23. I could have guessed, but you know. Luke 23. What is his response to all of the things that happen to him and that are done to him? Notice Luke 23, two other men are executed with him. And they put one on his right, one on his left. Verse 34, Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they divided up his clothes by casting lots. So whether he's referring to the thieves or he's referring to the people who are killing him, his attitude is, "God, please forgive them. They don't really know what they're doing." So his response is forgiveness. Then the people continue to mock him. Then, verse 39, one of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us." The one guy is dying on his one side, says to him, like, "If you're the guy, get us out of here." But the other criminal rebuked him. "Don't you fear God," he said, "since you are under the same sentence? We are punished justly, for we're getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong." And then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus answered him, "Dude, you're guilty. You're going to fry." "No." Jesus answered him, "I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise." So the few lines of dialogue that the writers do give Jesus, his heart is bent on forgiveness and invitation. So all of these things that are done to him, and he's mocked and spit on and struck in the face, every line that he's given is a line of almost like a soft-hearted forgiving and inviting. "Hey, today you'll be with me. Today you'll be with me." And then turn over to the book of John, the end of John 21, please. Or let's go to 19. There's a couple other pictures we get of how Jesus responds to what's done to him. John 19, there's a little section in verse 25. Near the cross of Jesus stood his mother, his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, that would be John, he said to his mother, "Dear woman, here is your son." And to the disciple, "Here is your mother." And from that time on, this disciple took her into his home. So he's on the cross. He's probably mostly naked. He's been whipped and beaten in the head and spit on, and the crowds are yelling at him. And according to this passage, his thought is, he's the oldest son, and his thought is, "Who's going to care for my mother when I'm gone?" And so he says to one of his disciples, "Take my mom and take care of her." So when we're given these pictures of how he responds to what's being done to him, it's forgiveness, it's invitation, and it's caring. I got to make sure my mom is okay. And then notice chapter 21. His disciples desert him and end up back in the Galilee, back at their businesses. They go back to work, fishing, and fishing isn't going well. And Jesus appears and tells them, "We'll just go on the other side of the boat." And so they go on the other side of the boat, and then they have all sorts of fish. So Jesus is brought face to face with one of his best friends, his disciple, who had betrayed him. And verse 10 of John 21, Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you've just caught." And so Simon Peter climbed aboard and dragged the net ashore. Verse 12, Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples asked him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. By the way, he cooked, maybe. Jesus came, took the bread and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. So he spends probably a couple years telling them, "Listen, I'm going to suffer and die, and then I'm going to rise from the dead." When it actually happens, instead of staying true to what he had said, they just desert and they go back to work and they deny him and they completely freak out, I assume like I would do. Then he appears with them later and you picture him just like, "Okay, guys, like coming down the beach, now it's time to roll up the sleeves and even the score because you weren't there." No. "Hey, you guys want some breakfast?" So to the people who have denied him and the people who have deserted him, "You want some breakfast?" And he feeds them. And then verse 15, when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" "Yes, Lord," he said, "you know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my lambs." And Jesus asked, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me?" "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Take care of my sheep." Third time he says to them, "Simon, do you love me?" This is verse 17. Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep." And so essentially Jesus reinstates him. "I got work for you to do. I got work for you to do. I know that you denied me. I know that everything fell apart. I know that you're a chicken. But listen, I'm going to take you and I still have work for you to do because I haven't given up hope on you." So Jesus' response to everything that's happened to him is love, forgiveness, invitation, caring for others. And then with Peter, it's like, "I know you did all that stuff to me. I've forgiven you, but I got work for you to do. I got work for you to do. Feed my sheep. Take care of the people." Next slide. Jesus had choices. Because he was wronged and he was betrayed and he was cheated on and he was deserted and he was gossiped about and he was mocked and all sorts of things happened to him that we don't know anything about. Nothing that we can relate to. And Jesus had choices about how he would respond. He had choices about whether or not he would respond with evil. He would spit back. He would throw a fist back. He would pick up a club and fight. Or he would respond with something else. And in every passage that we're given, he responds with love. He responds with love. He never once becomes the evil that is done to him. You never hear him say, "Just give me time and I have lots of it because I made it and I will get even." You never have him, when he's mocked, come back with some sort of mocking line in response. You never ever see him responding with what's being done to him with the same kinds of things, essentially stooping to their level. He responds with love every single time. Are we all seeing that here? He's given choices, and his response is always love. It's always love. And then, a couple days later, he rises from the dead, which no one's done before. He wins. He wins. He does what no one's ever done before. He never, like one writer said, he's tempted in all the same ways as us. He just doesn't give in. Which has fascinating consequences for us. Number one, next slide. Here's one point. He says this, "I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world." I have overcome the world. I win. I win. No one's ever lived the perfect life, and no one has ever been able to restrain and hold back from doing at least one act of evil, but I am loving the whole way through. I've overcome the world. I've done it. No one's done it. I did it. I did it. I did it. Rose from the dead. Did it. Did it. There's a little swagger there. Would you agree? I've overcome the world. I did it. No one's done that. Show me someone who's done that. One writer even said later, like, where are the poets and the philosophers? I mean, Jesus rose from the dead. Who's done that? Never seen that at a party, have you? There's like a swagger. There's like a, I've overcome the world. Which tells me a couple things. Next slide. There's a new way that the universe works. See, if the cross is just about getting you out of hell into heaven, then we've missed the cosmic significance of it. The cross is God's way of pushing the way that the universe works into an entirely new realm. Jesus overcomes death, so now the universe functions in a different way. It's not like it used to be, because good defeated evil in one decisive moment in which somebody actually lived a loving life and never gave in once. Never once gave the finger in traffic. Once. And you're thinking, well, I've never done that. Pride. No one once ever gave in to any of that and then conquers death. So there's somebody who can say, death, not a problem for me. The universe now works. If you miss this, you miss. It's not just a person getting freed from their sin so they can cut. It's about a way that we fundamentally believe the universe works. And if you're a Christian, then you have to take it all the way and acknowledge that has evil been overcome, yes or no? And if you are a Christian and you take the scripture seriously, then you have to come to the conclusion that the universe now works in a different way, and that a point in time, evil was crushed, and now we're dealing with kind of a skirmish, but the real battle has been decisively won. I have overcome the world. The universe now functions according to a different set of laws. So when somebody says, so-and-so got me, and I will wait, and I will get revenge, I will get even with them, they are demonstrating that they are living according to the way the universe used to work. But the universe now functions a different way, because Jesus says, I've overcome it. This is what other writers picked up on this. Next slide. Said things like this. Later they started to realize what the implications of this were. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. They understood that every day we're faced with these endless choices of how we're going to respond to the world. Are we going to overcome the world with more evil? So somebody does something to me, and then I'm going to respond with something that's evil, but it's more creative evil, or it's more clever evil, or it's just better form of evil. Or will I respond with good? And this is determined by how you view that the way the universe works. Because if you still view that we're in evil against evil, then you'll continue to, I'll get revenge. I'll pull ahead of them, then I'll pull into their lane and slow down. Yeah, that'll show them. They'll just pull over by the side of the road and weep in repentance. So the spouse, husband or wife, says something and it's just grinding inside of you because they brought up something from the past and they made this little teeny dig, but you were on your way out the door so you couldn't respond. So then you come home and you think, will I bring up his ex-girlfriend or his ex-employer? Which will I bring? Because I can do that. I can play that. And so now this little thing he brought up in me that's painful, I can just bring out his little thing because he has my buttons, but I know his. And so it's this, and how will I respond? Well, if the universe works the way it used to, well, then I got to push his buttons, but push one more button, because I have to win this confrontation. I have to make him hurt a tad bit more. I have to make her hurt a tad bit more. I have to make that person feel a little bit more left out, because then I win. But if the universe now works a different ways, then Jesus has overcome it. And the only way the universe works is that good just keeps winning and keeps crushing. Now let's take this deeper. Next. The writers later began to understand that this had ramifications even beyond the way the universe works. Having disarmed the powers and authorities, Jesus made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them by the cross. Now, public spectacle is a fascinating turn of phrase here, because he's left naked in public to die, which would be, in the day, his day, Romans 1, Jesus 0. Are we tracking on that? It's a public victory by those who want him dead. But if you can do the worst possible thing to somebody, strip them naked, mock them, and murder them in public, if you can do the worst possible thing to somebody and they still live, then who wins? You killed me. That's the worst you can do to somebody. But as far as I know, I'm cooking fish. Okay, that's why the public thing is so huge and significant. Is it saying you can do anything to this Jesus and he still overcomes it? The worst evil can do, and we'll spend a couple weeks from now, we'll spend a whole day on this, because the ramifications of this are mind-blowing. But if you can do the worst possible public thing to somebody and they still live, then it goes from a public defeat to a public victory, which is why they speak of Jesus in terms of victory, triumphing. Next slide. Let's put it this way. The powers that appear to be winning lose, and the person who appears to be losing wins. And if the universe works in a different way than it used to because of the cross, then this is true today even more than it was then, because it has a whole history of truth behind it. The powers that put Jesus on the cross, that mock him, strip him naked, divide up his clothing, spit on him, slap him, beat him on the head with a stick, pierce his sides with spikes, those powers at that moment appear like they're winning and like they have the power. Would you agree? They appear like they're winning. But in the end, they lose, because the worst that they can do, he just rises from the dead. So the powers that appear as though they're winning lose. And the person who appears naked and bloody as if he's losing actually wins. So you're at the water cooler and you're being mocked because you're a person of faith. And everybody's getting their little jab in and you're apparently losing according to the office scorecard because you're the freak Christian. And so it appears as though you lose and they win. But hopefully everybody wins. But the essence of the cross is that the person who appears as though they may be losing walks with God, and God takes care of them, no matter what the circumstances look like at the moment. If this is the case, next slide, then the cross is God's way of saying love wins. The cross is God's way of saying, listen, I know what they did to you. Love wins. I know what they're saying about you, and you have these choices, because we have choices. The cross is God's way of saying, listen, whatever it is, I know they abused you. I know they sexually molested you. I know. I saw it. I was there. I was weeping with you. And so you have these choices now that you've dug it up. And we're 20 years down the road, and you can respond in one of many ways. But let me tell you, love wins. The cross is God's way of saying the only thing that will ultimately win, it doesn't mean that we condone, it doesn't mean that we say, hey, it was no big deal, it doesn't mean that we brush over it, but it means that ultimately love wins. Love wins. So that when you're in traffic, love wins. Love wins. Not, When you're walking down the hall at school and you're coming to the collection of lockers and you know who's going to be standing here and you know what they're going to say about you and you know they're going to talk about the way you dress and they know, love wins. No matter what is done to us, love wins. Do you believe that? Because if the cross is real and it happened, then the universe works in a different way. And if the universe now functions according to different laws, then love wins. It wins on the cross, and so it wins tomorrow, and it wins at the next family reunion. Are we preaching yet? Okay, it wins tomorrow with the person four cubicles over who is a contestant for most annoying employee in the world. Love wins. It wins. And you have choices about how you're going to respond. Next slide. Like one writer. Switch to a foreign language I don't know, and then I'll come back to English. First, like a writer just said, love never fails. Ever, 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 ever. Love never fails. Doesn't. It can't. It's incapable of failing. Which I think raises a new thing. Next slide. Love always wins. It's like a new law. It's a new law in the universe. You like that one? It only took 6 months to come up with. It always wins. No. I know what you're thinking. But you don't understand my brother-in-law. Yeah, we do. We do. Okay? And love still wins with him. Correct? Would you agree? Correct? Well, you don't understand my 16-year-old kid. Okay, we don't. Yeah, you're right. We don't. But love wins. But you don't understand my neighbor is of a different orientation. Love wins with your neighbor too. Would you agree? Love wins. Now, I don't know about you, but I need reminders of this a lot. Anybody else here? I need tattoos of this. I need this in my home. I don't necessarily need it on the bumper of my car. I need it on the bumper of the car ahead of me. Correct? I don't necessarily need it in my desk as much as I need it when I'm in somebody else's work area and I'm interacting. Or maybe they come. I need it on the forehead of every person that I meet, because this would help me, because I need to be reminded on a regular basis, because otherwise I fall into patterns that aren't love winning. Would you agree? Anybody else? So I started thinking about how I'm always making fun of Christian bumper stickers. So I decided to design my own bumper sticker, and I had 10,000 of them made. And I took them out of the box they came in so that you could each get one. Somebody told me, hey, be careful, the box doesn't hold together. Anyway, what I'd like to see everywhere I go in Grand Rapids is love wins. Okay, I want to see it on foreheads. I want to see it on limbs. I want to see it on... I want to see it on the car in front of me and the car in front of that car. I want to see it in all sorts of interesting places, because to me, this is one of the central meanings of the cross. Is the cross is God's way of saying love wins, and you're going to get slapped, and you're going to get beaten, and you're going to get mocked, and you're going to get spit on, and you're going to be betrayed, and you're going to have friends who put the knife in your back, and you're going to get criticized, and you're going to have people who keep falling asleep on you. Even people that you really love aren't going to be there for you at key times, and it's in those moments when you need this. Would you agree? Because it happens, and Jesus had choices. So I would say week number one at the cross. The cross is God's way of saying love wins. I think we need to speak this to each other. We need to speak it a lot. We need to call our friends and just say, hey, love wins. Okay? It's like spiritual prank calling, so it's okay. You know what I mean? I think some of us, when we go into situations, we know, this situation, so-and-so is going to be there, and it's going to pull up all this stuff, and it's going to make me into this kind of person that I don't want to become. Did you ever find yourself in situations, and you just want to stand up and immediately begin flogging yourself because you think, I become this other person when I'm in fill in the blank? Anybody? Like, who takes possession of this body for these brief moments with this particular person? And you just think we need an exorcism or something, because this is not me, but I get in certain things, and I need to be reminded before those kinds of situations that love wins. And the cross is God's way of saying to us, in all of our brokenness, and all of our tendency to respond all these different ways. Hey, Jesus went through everything and more and responded in love. It's been done. Somebody did it. They actually responded in love the whole way through. And they did it, and now they sent their spirit to live inside of you so that you can do it. Let's bow our heads, shall we, for a moment of reflection, silence. If the choir directors would come back up, we should probably close in a song. And how about the ushers? If the ushers could come and each grab a chunk of stickers from the pile that I've made on the stage, we'll have them hand these as you exit. Dear God, many of us were, all of us were faced with these circumstances every day. This afternoon, even at lunch, in the parking lot, where everything within us wants to respond, wants to play the game, wants to get in and try to even the score. And we realize that there's a different scoreboard. And often it's a scoreboard we can't see, which makes it hard. But we acknowledge that something, as Christians, we acknowledge that something happened 2,000 years ago that changes the whole way the universe works. And so we celebrate that, and we wrestle with it, and we want to go deeper. So help us, even the next few weeks, to begin to expand and open up what else you might be teaching us through the resurrection. We thank you that it's not just a cross, but it's an empty tomb. We thank you that it's not just a naked and bloody Messiah, but it's a Jesus fully dressed saying, "Do you want some fish?" Feeding on top of his game. We thank you. And so please help us to live this. Not just talk about it, but live it. Because we want to be people of the way. We want to be known not for just some stuff we're carrying around in our heads, but the ways that we actually live when it's most difficult. We thank you. And we praise you. And in Jesus' name, everybody said, amen.